The two most powerful Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. I don't know if the United Arab Emirates are second most powerful. Saudi Arabia certainly is because of its not only great wealth in terms of oil, but also because it's the largest purchaser of American weaponry. The United Arab Emirates, not so much. They are incensed by Qatar's hosting of a Doha-based Yusuf al-Qaradawi, a influential pro-brotherhood preacher who they see as a potent political menace. They're also furious about Qatar's use of its Al Jazeera broadcaster and Qatari television to promote brotherhood views, critical of other Gulf Arab states, and Al Jazeera's airtime for groups with Al-Qaeda ties in Syria. Well, the fact is that if you're a rebel in Syria, you are a fundamentalist Muslim. You are a jihadist. And since Qatar thought that it would be appropriate to depose Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, but not appropriate for him to depose himself in Qatar, what's the difference between the monarchy in Saudi Arabia, the emir in Kuwait, and Muammar Gaddafi in Libya? Really, what's the difference? If you're going to say that Assad, as the king of Syria, has no legitimacy, why would the Saud royal family have legitimacy in Arabia? And it's that problem that the rest of the Gulf Arab states are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're all a house of cards. We're all glass houses here. What on earth are you doing with this approach, whether it be Al Jazeera or with your importing weapons to weaponize protest, overthrow governments? Now, at a time when Sunni militants are resurgent in the Middle East and Northern Africa, and thousands of foreigners are fighting with Al-Qaeda-aligned groups in Syria, actually, they're just fighting with fundamentalist Islamic groups in Syria, many Gulf Arab officials perceive Qatar's continued support of Islamists as reckless. But they are all Islamists. Every monarch, every emir, every dictator, every potentate throughout the Islamic Middle East are Islamic. They all are. There's not an exception. Those that were a bit secular are either gone, as is Saddam Hussein, in the process of going, Assad, and or gone completely, as is the case of Muammar Gaddafi. Qatar, a U.S. ally, is signaling defiance. Quote, the independence of Qatar's foreign policy is simply not negotiable, Foreign Minister Khalid al-Attiyah said in a speech in Paris this month. I think what he really ought to have said is the hypocrisy of Qatar's foreign policy is not negotiable. It's not rational either. In the case of Syria, diplomats and sources close to the government say it's unlikely to abandon groups that are among the toughest in fighting President Bashar al-Assad's forces, no matter the flak its policy takes from both sides, from allies and from enemies. Qatar's Syria policy matters not only because Doha remains a generous backer of the opposition, but also because its dispute with other funders, notably Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Its dispute with other funders, you get that? In Saudi Arabia and in Qatar, they are equally in lockstep providing American weapons to Mujahideen, to jihadists. This is important because, you know, in the 17th chapter of Yeshayah, Isaiah has told us that Damascus is going to fall, as is the Syrian government, and that the fall of Damascus and the Syrian government is going to lead directly to the dismemberment of Israel, which leads directly to an Islamic assault of great multitudes, a flood of Muslims, wielding American weapons, unstoppable in their attempt to destroy Israel. This is important. And you find that Qatar and Saudi Arabia are on the same side, supplying American weapons to the Mujahideen, and yet opposed to one another in their relationships with the Muslim Brotherhood, the wellspring from which each of these terrorist organizations has originally emerged in Egypt. It reminds me a little bit of what is actually happening in Syria right at the moment, where the two most effective Islamic jihadi groups, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, and the al-Nusra Front, are now fighting and killing one another. We now have Sunni Muslims at each other's throats. Hello, John. We have John calling in from Texas. What part of this discussion strikes your fancy, John?
Well, you saw the email that I sent you concerning the words of Jesus only.
Oh, yes. Now I recognize John from Texas. Yeah, I did ask you to call in. You had a series of questions, and this would be a fine time to depart from the news to go to the questions that you asked it for our listeners. John sent a series of questions that he derived from a website. I don't think it was the Jesus Words Only website. I think you referenced a different website there. And why don't you articulate for our listeners kind of one at a time what your questions were and why you thought that maybe there was a some reasonability in the issues that they raised.
Well, first off, as I put in my email, I'm just looking at this site. It's confusing to me in comparison with what we have talked about and you've spoken about in according to the Torah. And so, where most arguments will try to say that the law is done away with, this guy and this site in particular, he says that and now I'm using his words, Jesus came to fulfill the law, meaning that it was not perfect, but he filled it up, that he completed it.
Okay, let's deal with one point at a time. First of all, if a individual does not know Yahusha's name, they do not know him. That's just as simple as I can say it. If they do not know that his name is Yahusha, and they think that his name was Jesus, and they have no idea who he actually is, what he stood for, what he represented, what he conveyed, and they automatically disqualify themselves as being a credible source by misnaming him. His name is extraordinarily important. It means that Yahweh is the one that's saving us. And unless you know how he relates to Yahweh, then you'd have no capability of knowing who he is or what he was saying. Okay, the second point. Torah is not law. It's just not law. It's the word Torah was defined by Yahweh based upon the verb yara, and the verb yara means to instruct, to teach, to guide. If you guide your children, are you laying down the law for your children?
No.
No. No. Fathers instruct. They teach. They guide, as do mothers. They don't establish laws. And so this concept that there was a law that needed something done to it to make it right, you're starting off on the wrong foot. You're taking a religious interpretation that is wholly and completely inconsistent with the terminology Yahweh himself used. Now, the next point, before we go on, just to break down the first argument. The inference that that the law was imperfect, that it was inadequate, and therefore it was fulfilled, and fulfilling it made it, took something that was wrong and somehow made it right, something that was incomplete and somehow made it complete, is rationally stupid, to coin a very sophisticated term. If the Torah was errant in any way, then Yahweh is disqualified as God. If the Torah is inaccurate in any way, Yahusha is disqualified as his representative. God says is perfect. God says his Torah is perfect. He says it's, in fact, God even says in one of the Proverbs, he says, my Torah is perfect, lacking nothing, and is fully capable of restoring your soul. So if that's not true, which this person is claiming, that's not true, that the Torah is incomplete, that it is imperfect, then Yahweh, who inspired the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, is a liar. Now, how in the world can the representative of God, Yahusha, represent a liar and be telling the truth? Not even rational, is it?
No.
Okay, let's go one step further. Yahusha, in his, what he's trying to get around is the opening statement that Yahusha made in the Sermon on the Mount. Because he knows that in the Sermon on the Mount, Yahusha says that, do not think that I have come to annul or do away with or negate any aspect of the Torah. Do not think that. I came to fulfill it. Now, before I explain what fulfill means, let's go on to the next thing that he said. He says, not a single yod or tittle. Yod is the smallest letter in the Hebrew language. It's the first letter that comprises Yahweh's name. It means hand, and it's the Y in Yahweh's name. It's the smallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet. There's not a single yod or tittle. A tittle is the crown or upper strokes that comprise many of the Hebrew letters. It's just a component of a letter. And he's saying not the smallest letter, not any component of a letter is going to be done away with. Stay with us, John. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with John in Texas, who is writing and calling about some concerns about the role of the Torah and what Yahusha said and did relative to the Torah. John, the point that Yahusha made in concert was saying that do not think that I came to do away with the Torah. I came to fulfill it. And then he said, not a single yod, which is the smallest Hebrew letter, or stroke of any letter, which comprise the words, which comprise the sentences, which comprise the Torah, are going to be done away with, and so long as the heaven and earth exist. John, I'm looking out my window. It looks to me like the earth's still here.
I'm in agreement.
Okay. So that means that every stroke of every letter, of every Hebrew word that is in the Torah is still in full effect, according to Yahusha. And he ought to know, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so if somebody is saying that Yahusha said, you know, that the Torah is not complete, it's not perfect, there's parts of it that need fixing, that things that he needed to change, then what they're saying is the opposite of what Yahusha said. Would that be correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so if you're going to quote somebody and then turn what they say to make it the opposite of what they said, you don't have much credibility. You've destroyed your credibility. Now that we know that, let's look at what the word fulfill means. Let's say that I borrowed $1,000 from you, and we wrote a promissory note where I promised to pay the $1,000 back over a period of time with interest. Now, if I fulfill that promise, and I pay you the money back with interest, have I changed that promissory note? No. Have I honored the promissory note?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Does the promissory note seem to be cease to be relevant relative to this transaction, or is it simply this is the written affirmation of what I promised to do, and by fulfilling my promise, I'm honoring it, and you get your money back? Is it just simply a written affirmation of what I've done?
I agree.
So when we put promises in writing, and the Torah is filled with promises, when Yahweh put his promises in writing and the terms and conditions for us availing ourselves of those promises in writing, and then he himself, through Yahusha, fulfills those promises, isn't he just enabling, isn't he just honoring what he said he was going to do?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how does fulfill somehow mean change? I mean, where in the world does fulfill mean change? I mean, alter. How does fulfill mean do away with?
Well, it doesn't.
Of course it doesn't. But not only doesn't it mean do away with, to change, to alter, to ignore, to annul, not only doesn't it mean any of those things, in the specific context where Yahusha said, I came to fulfill it, he was explaining that the Torah's teaching is in effect so long as the heavens and earth are here, and that we should not think what this guy is proclaiming. He said, just, I'm going to start this whole thing out by telling you, do not think that I came to annul, to do away with, to alter the Torah. So the very statement that he is making is in wholesale conflict with the fellow whose name he doesn't even know. He's not starting off on very good ground, is he?
That's for sure.
All right. What's the next point?
And I'm kind of going down the list of the things that I highlighted. The Moses quoting not rabbinical Talmudic Jewish leadership, but they quoted the Torah. He always seemed to correct it and make it something else, other than what they thought. For instance, he would always say, you have heard it said, and then there would be something from the Torah, don't kill, right? Don't commit adultery. But I say, and then he would go ahead and, as this guy claims, fulfill that law or perfect it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there's a couple examples in the Beatitudes. And that, which is the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. He said, you have heard it said. If you actually take the time to understand what he said, he's not quoting the Torah. He's actually quoting, and there's three of them. And one of each of them represents a misinterpretation of God's instruction, one by the Sadducees, one by the Pharisees, and one by the Essenes. And he takes them systematically. It's one of the more interesting studies that we can do in the Dead Sea Scrolls, is to understand the mindset of these three religious sects and how he was attacking them. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. The advocate who's already completely disqualified himself by not knowing Yahusha's name, misnaming him Jesus, by saying that this individual meant by fulfilling to change, to alter, when that's not what fulfill means. By taking the fulfill concept out of the context of Yahusha's declaration of how we ought not think that he came to alter, annul, change, abrogate the Torah, but instead to fulfill it, and that not a single stroke of a single letter that comprises the Torah is going to be done away with so long as the heavens and earth exist. Now uses the argument that, but I say, you have heard it read, you have heard it said, but I say, as the proof that he was into changing things. Well, there are a number of arguments against that. First of all, this is the only place where he uses that phraseology, and every place else he simply quotes what's in the Torah. He quotes from the Torah more often than any other book. He answers questions based upon what's in the Torah. Someone will ask him a question and says, well, what did the Torah say? So he certainly cannot be suggesting in this particular context, John, that he is changing the Torah when he just, in a matter of sentences, I mean, the next thing out of his mouth after the you have heard what I say is, don't think that I come to change the Torah. Don't come to think that I have annulled it. Every letter is going to stay in full effect. So if he meant that I am here to change it, then he would have immediately contradicted himself and proven that he wasn't worthy of citing. Wouldn't that be true?
I would say yes. That's what I would say.
Yeah. So there's a different reason that he has made the distinction, for example, between committing adultery and your attitude towards women, right? Against false witness versus your attitude in making a statement. And I dare say what he's talking about here is attitudinal. It's the single most important part of a relationship. It's our attitude towards Yahweh is more important than anything else. You know, if we view Yahweh, God, as a Lord who gave laws, then our attitude, our approach to him, is completely the antithesis of what he wants to convey. He wants to convey that he's a father providing instructions so that we can be part of his family. And so attitude, what he's saying here is our attitude is really important. You know, don't make a religion based upon laws, but instead it's your attitude that you really ought to get right. Your perspective on God, your motivation towards God, and your fellow man is what you ought to get right as opposed to a bunch of legalism. That's what he's conveying. But let me ask you this. What this individual is trying to do is say, Moses is bad. Moses, really bad information, incomplete, inaccurate. And so the you have heard, but I say, you've got the Christian Jesus here rescinding what Moses had written. That's the inference, correct?
Yes. He's saying that, basically what I gather from it, he's saying that God's law was perfect, but he had to use imperfect Moses until Yahushua could come along.
Okay. Now, so that being the case, I want to ask you a question here. Of the adultery and false witness, which are the first two of the you have heard what I say, those are attributed to the 10 statements that are written on the two tablets of stone, are they not?
Yes.
Who wrote the two tablets of stone?
I would say Moshe.
So you think that when Moshe came down with these two tablets of stone that he said were etched by the finger of God himself, you think that Moshe was lying, that God didn't in fact write write in stone the 10 instructions found on those two tablets?
No, he was telling the truth.
Okay. So the argument this person is trying to make is that Moshe wrote those 10 statements, and Moshe was a flawed conveyor of information, when in fact, according to the Torah, and Yahweh is speaking in first person, and he speaks in first person throughout the 10 statements that he etched in stone. Yahweh etched those in stone. In fact, Yahweh says that those two tablets still exist. They're right now inside the Ark of the Covenant. He's going to show them to the world. What's this guy going to say when they're in Yahweh's own hand? Is he going to say God was imperfect? God was an imperfect implement for writing these 10 instructions and etching them in stone? Boy, that is a limb on which I would not want to be hanging. Yes, to say that God himself is incapable of communicating accurately and of articulating a fair and reasonable program to us. That's what they are saying. Now, I'm going to agree that Moshe was a flawed implement. So am I. Man, if it wasn't for flawed implements, none of us would be able to work with God, because flawed implements is all he has to work with. And Yahweh seems to like working with flawed implements more than he likes working with those who claim to have all the answers. And it's because as flawed implements, we realize our limitations. Moshe realized his limitations. There is very little of the Torah that is that comes from Moshe. The Torah, in the Torah, Yahweh either speaks in first person or you have Moshe helping the listeners understand what God had said. I mean, so the Torah through the first four books is all God speaking through him in first person. And Moshe wasn't the only one, by the way, that was up there on the top of the mountain for 40 days listening to God dictate his Torah. As a matter of fact, even when Moshe came down with the two tablets, God himself, in his own voice, conveyed his Torah that Moshe had written down before all of the children of Israel. But the only thing that's in addition to that is Devarim, which has been corrupted to Deuteronomy. Moshe is doing essentially what I do in all of the books that are available, yadayah.com, introductiontogod.org, introtogod.org, yadayah.com. What I will do is say, this is what God said. And if you think about every word, if you analyze every word, if you put this in the context of other things that God has told us, this is a way for you to look at this and have a more complete understanding of it. It's a explanation of the testimony of God. Now, does God's testimony need our explanation? No. You can read what Yahweh had to say, and you're fully capable of understanding it. He's a very effective communicator. But it doesn't hurt to have somebody say, oh, this is related to something else he said. For example, in the second of those statements, most people don't know that God said that not only do fathers corrupt their children to the third and fourth generation, but that his mercy is available to thousands who observe, closely examine, and carefully consider the conditions of his covenant. So that's worthy of commentary. It's worthy just to stop the reader and say, let's think about what this means. Thousands amongst billions is one in a million. Not going to be a lot of members of his family, are there?
No.
And does it help then to say, when Yahweh wrote in stone that thousands will be the beneficiary of his mercy by closely examining and carefully considering the conditions of the covenant, does it help, you think, a reader if you say, you know, during this Sermon on the Mount, this instruction on the Mount, Yahusha affirmed this when he said that the way is narrow and very few find life, but the way is broad and very popular that leads to death. I think it's helpful to relate those statements because they affirm the same truth. They actually affirm the truth that Christianity can't be a path to life because it's popular. It's the most popular religion in human history. So you have a lot of problems with his second statement. One is that he annuls that writer's viewpoint in the next point that he makes, which is he says, don't think that I came to change this. Don't think that I came to annul it. He's just talking about attitude. And really, the most important aspect of it is of the you have heard it said, but I say, is beyond the attitude of it is, if you really want to understand what somebody is conveying, you have to take the time to know the inclinations of that period, what those who heard this would have understood. And they all knew that these were essential doctrines and differences between the Essenes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. And he systematically annihilated their credibility in those first three statements. They were all tied up in their underwear over laws that they had imposed and their interpretation of laws. And, of course, the second is that you can't criticize Moshe relative to the 10 statements without implicating Yahweh, because Yahweh claimed to have written those in stone with his own hand. We didn't see Moshe taking a chisel up there. Okay. So, sure. What's the next one? I mean, thus far, by the way, in the nature of a debate, of an argument like this, once you have proven yourself untrustworthy once on your main issue, it's over. So he's already lost every aspect of his first 2 points.
Oh, I agree. If nothing else, I'd just like for you to comment on
sure
some of the things.
We have the music playing, but we'll return to this discussion when we get back. This is an individual who is, I don't think, is associated with Jesus' words only. It's a site that, from what I've seen, actually does some pretty decent work, but instead writes for a site, JesusFamilies.org, is where this nincompoop is from. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a conversation with John, who's called in from Hawaii, who has some questions regarding statements that a fellow writing for JesusFamilies.org had to say about the mythical person known as Jesus somehow annulling and doing away with, perfecting, whatever it may be, the law, even though there is no law. There is a Torah, but there is no law. And everything he has said thus far has been contradicted by both Yahweh, who happens to be God, and Yahusha, who is the diminished manifestation of Yahweh. Let's try one more, John. What else did they have to say?
Well, that the Jewish leadership, which claimed, quoted the Torah, not that they weren't rabbinical or Talmudic. Maybe they were as well, but he told them they searched the scriptures because they thought in them they had eternal life.
Wait a minute. I mean, so this person is so out of touch with reality that he is of the conviction that the rabbinical types did not have an oral law, that they didn't have the Talmud, that they didn't rely on their own arguments. Is that what he's trying to say? Is that God was opposed to the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the scribes for reading the Torah as opposed to their love affair with their own religious documents? Is that the argument?
I think he's saying that they were searching the Torah.
Yeah, no, they weren't. Yosha didn't say that. Yosha's argument with them was that they had made up their own rules. And read his attack on them in Matanya 23. He is just livid with them because he calls them pure hypocrites. And he goes into explicit details of how they manage to twist things in their own arguments. And so their problem was that while Yosha cited the Torah with great regularity, told us that the Torah would always be in effect, and Yahweh's most common request was for us to observe the Torah. So if Yosha said, you know, your problem is you're observing the Torah, and Yahweh says the single most important thing you can do is observe the Torah, that would mean that Yosha was either a nincompoop or he was in direct conflict with Yahweh. It's not possible for Yahweh to say, Shamar Torah, and for Yosha to say, hey, your problem is that you shouldn't be observing the Torah. I mean, that's just nonsensical. And it would be nonsensical to not recognize the reality of the fact that the rabbinic community of that day, and they were the Pharisees, but the liberal political and religious party was the Sadducees. that they did not have their own oral law. The oral law is what forms the basis of rabbinic Judaism. And at the time of Yehoshua, rabbinic Judaism had prevailed in the Jewish ruling establishment. By that time, the Lowi or Levites were no more. There was only one Jewish religion. There's only been one Jewish religion since that time. It's rabbinical. So this fellow evidently is completely out of touch with historical reality.
So they were searching the Talmudic. Oh,
of course, that's what they do now. Go and have a discussion with any rabbi. They will almost never cite the Torah. They always cite the Talmud. And when a rabbi studies, they study the Talmud. They study the Mishnah. Always has been. A religious Jew is not Torah observant. They're Talmud observant. They're Mishnah observant. That's just the reality of it. It has been for 2,000 years. And for someone not to know that and to make a statement otherwise is just inexcusable, to be that unfamiliar with reality and yet present oneself as an expert. But John, I'm glad that you called and brought up these questions. If there are more of them that you'd like answered, we'll deal with them in a future program. We have Kevin, who has called in from Paradise, from Hawaii. Either has a question on or a statement regarding the covenant, and we will turn to Kevin when Shattering Myths continues after the commercial break.